Hey, I'm Emily Alphen Johnson, VPR Digital Producer, and you're listening to the Vermont Edition Podcast. This episode has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Every 4 years, the federal government is required to publish a national climate assessment. It doesn't always meet its own deadlines, but these reports are supposed to be used for shaping policy around what science tells us about our climate future. A draft of the new National Climate Report was leaked several months back and is getting some interesting takes and responses from people who have pored over what it says. The report is not officially okayed by the Trump administration, but it is available for anyone who wants to see it at this point. And our guests today have given it some thought. We're going to talk about how climate change is affecting our region with Kurt Steger, a professor of natural sciences at Paul Smith's College in Paul Smith's, New York. Hello, Professor Steger. Nice to talk with you again.
Hello.
And Jillian Galford, assistant professor at UVM's Gund Institute for Environment. Professor Galford, nice to talk with you again as well.
Thanks, Jane.
Jillian, can I start with you? This report is part of this big effort that's supposed to be done every 4 years. Can you tell us a little bit about what the National Climate Assessment is?
The National Climate Assessment was legally mandated by the 1990 Global Change Research Act. And every 4 years, there's supposed to be a report on the status of climate change and its impacts across the United States. Originally, this was meant to inform presidents, Congress, and it's sort of grown since then to be the definitive document on climate change and its impacts in the United States.
So it's been going on for almost 30 years now.
Yes, although you'll notice we're only on the fourth National
right.
Climate Assessment. So there have been some gaps. The National Climate Assessment has also moved to what they call a sustained assessment process. So instead of one massive release every 4 years, they're trying to put out information on a more continuous basis, starting with this climate science special report.
And this climate science special report doesn't advocate for policy changes. It's just supposed to be the science about what is happening and what we think we can predict or what scientists think they can predict for the near future.
Yeah. So this is the basis, the scientific basis for all the assessment work that will go on in this fourth National Climate Assessment. And it's up to the following documents to look at its impacts, for example, on agriculture or energy.
And who's putting this together?
This is done by the United States Global Change Research Program, which involves 13 federal agencies. To my knowledge, it's the largest interaction of that many federal agencies. So everything from ag, commerce, defense, energy, to NASA, foreign aid, and much more.
Kurt Steger, anything in this report that you would characterize as a revelation from the last report?
The information isn't that wildly different in terms of temperature and precipitation, but I think maybe the biggest take-home message that I see in it is that climate change is not just something in the far future, but it's here now, and it's largely due to us now as well. So the science has just gotten a whole lot stronger on that.
Yeah, it sounds like from the report there's not a lot of equivocation. It's basically saying, yes, it's caused by us. And in fact, we can point to several particular weather events and say with a high probability that the severity of it at least is partially caused by climate change.
Yeah, that's right. We still have the natural variations, El Nino and things like that going on, and we will. But what we've been doing now is sort of loading the dice, whenever we toss the weather dice, towards the extremes of temperature and heavier events and, of course, sea level rise as well. So it's exacerbating risks that we already face.
And specifically to the Northeast and to our region, what's the takeaway message, Kurt, in terms of what this report is telling us about climate change here in New England and the Northeast?
Sure. It's important to remember that they chose a large area of the Northeast. So it's from Maine down to Maryland and West Virginia. So it wouldn't be specifically just for Vermont, and there'd be some variation here. But the big picture is over the last century, there's been almost 2 degrees Fahrenheit of warming in that region. It's gotten wetter, maybe about 10% wetter on average. Sea level's gone up by about a foot. But when they picked out the northeastern region out of the country, they noticed that our region also had one of the largest increases in precipitation in the extreme events. So in other words, the heavy rainfall events that we would normally get are now heavier than they would otherwise have been. It's the amount of water falling in the heaviest 1% of storms. So that's something I've seen here in the Adirondacks as well, and a lot of us have seen within our own states and our own regions.
Jillian, can you put that in context with the rest of the United States? Because as this report points out, there's different changes in different regions. And yes, the Northeast is a sort of a large region in the report, but that's different from what people in the West are seeing, for example. So can you just give us the full picture?
Sure. So as you said, across the United States, there's very different impacts of climate change. And what we're facing in the Northeast is definitely increased precipitation. If we look towards the American Southwest, if you think of California, Nevada, places like that, they're actually seeing drying trends over the last century.
So it's not that everywhere in the United States is suddenly seeing more precipitation and stronger storms. It really varies depending on where you live and what your climate already is.
Absolutely, yeah.
And do you agree with Kurt that that's the sort of the main message here for the Northeast from the report, that we're already seeing it? We've already seen a 2-degree temperature rise in this, you know, starting a century ago, which is higher than the national average, and we're going to see more and stronger precipitation in these storms in the future?
Absolutely. And one of the things that I think is important if you live here is that you know that this average number of a 2 degrees increase, and we're looking at another 2-degree increase by the midpoint of this century, that it doesn't come evenly throughout the year. So we see more warming in nighttime winter temperatures, nighttime summer temperatures. So if you're thinking about how long does the snow stay on the ground, it's really affected by those nighttime winter temperatures. If you're thinking about nice sleeping weather, you're affected by those warmer summer temperatures. And those are trending upwards much faster than just that 2-degree average.
Right, because we may have more precipitation in these events doesn't mean that we're going to have a snowpack for the same duration that we had 50 years ago.
Certainly. It right now, we're getting a lot of snow. We see that trend. Perhaps out to 2030, we may have plenty of snow because we're still maintaining cool, long winter seasons. When we start getting closer to 2050 and beyond, that precipitation may come more as rain. It may not stay as cool at nighttime to maintain the snowpack. There's a lot more uncertainty.
Kurt Steger, can you sort of recap again or reiterate this idea of, in the Northeast, more precipitation, but how that is likely to come and how it is coming? You know, these big weather events versus sustained, rain throughout the season.
Right. Well, basically, when you heat up the whole planet and you heat up this engine of the climate system, you can sort of predict what's going on. It's the oceans are warmer and the air is warmer, so that means there's more evaporation and more moisture, humidity in the air. So when you make a rainstorm or maybe even a snowstorm, when it dumps, there's more moisture to dump. And the other thing is when you heat the land and the air up more as well, you make the air circulate more vigorously and you're more likely to get things like a big thunderstorm instead of a long, dreary drizzle. So you put those together and it gets to be pretty complicated looking into the future of what it would mean in terms of overall moistness in, let's say, your reservoir for drinking water and things. Because if you have the same amount of rain, let's say, during the year, but it comes all at once in these sudden bursts, a lot of it will just run off and go away and not soak into the ground. So ironically, you could even have it get wetter overall, and it comes in these big dumps, and it turns out the water table dries out a little bit and wells dry out in the summer because it's hot and it's not replenishing except in these sudden events where you lose a lot of the runoff. So basically, it's not surprising at all that we're seeing these extreme events. And you can see it registered in the local weather records in Vermont and here in the Adirondacks as well. You can see, like, for Dannemora here in New York, for Cornwall, Vermont weather station, you can see over the last century, a heavy rainstorm was maybe 3 inches or something like that. Now, since 1970, it's 3 to 4.5 inches in the heaviest storms.
Jillian Galford, do you think that means that we need to be thinking more carefully about more events like something like Tropical Storm Irene and how to cope with flooding or how to cope with our land development if this is our future. And this mm-hmm. is what the report is telling us from the scientific minds of this country is something that we should be prepared for.
Absolutely. And I do think the science report emphasizes those extreme events. And Kurt said something that's really important, so I want to emphasize it, is that as we increase temperatures and we're driving more evaporation, we're putting more water into the atmosphere and it's getting hotter, things become really kind of random in terms of, is it going to rain in Shelburne or is it going to rain in Burlington? Where's that storm going to hit? It's very hard to predict exactly where and when we'll have these big thunderstorms. And remember that heat is just energy. So you're building all these energy dynamics in the atmosphere that can be really unstable. So it becomes much harder to know, are we going to have a really wet May and a dry August, for example? And this report also emphasizes that these extremes have the potential to build on each other. And I think that's really where we get in trouble. So we saw that happen not that long ago during Tropical Storm Irene. So we had extreme rainfall early in the season, and then we had this very large storm come through. So the combination of those events is really what led to this catastrophic flooding in Vermont. So those types of events that build on each other, extreme on top of extreme, really put us at the most risk.
So when you say that the warming temperatures lead to more volatility and less of an ability to know in advance where something might be strongest, is that true already in very warm places on Earth? You know, can we learn anything from there? Or is it more that this overall picture is changing that volatility in ways that that are not familiar to us?
Sure. So the science report points to two ways that there are unexpected outcomes of climate change. So the first one I already talked about, that was sort of these compounding of events, so multiple extremes on top of each other. And the other one is tipping points. So that's when the system begins to physically function, the laws around physics start doing things that we haven't experienced in the past. And we've seen some of that in this area. For example, the jet stream has gotten locked in these troughs, and that's not something we saw decades and decades ago. We've seen it in the more recent decades. So the Arctic trough that we got locked into a few times here in recent years and has captured the news. So without a lot of observations of that, it's hard to forecast how long we'll be locked into that type of system, when it'll arrive, what conditions set it up. And that's really a limitation to our weather forecasters who already have a very difficult job.
Kurt, one of the things that sounds kind of alarming, and I don't think you're going to dissuade me of that notion from this report, is that, you know, there are a lot of predictions and there are a lot of models, but there is also a lot of unknowns or the idea that we could have strange things happen because of these changes to our climate that can't be predicted because we just don't know what's going to happen when the Earth warms. So that there's this idea that, you know, here's our best guess, but there could be something totally wild that we just have no way of anticipating, and that this report is saying, just want to put it out there that that's a possibility. Do you find that alarming?
Not really, because that's sort of the way the world works. And when, you know, I study climate history, so I'm used to looking at extremes of the distant past as well. So I think it's an important thing for the general public to practice this long-term view, which is important even if we didn't have human climate change. We're going to have surprises in the future anyway, and it's just common sense to anticipate this and try to be as resilient as we can, but also realize that the human impacts are complicating and intensifying these. So there's actually, although there's uncertainty, it's not a reason to reject the information because there's a spectrum of certainty. There are some things we know pretty much for sure, as long as you don't try to pin it down to an exact number of inches or degrees or locations. It's undisputable that we are going to get warmer in the future. So we don't have to worry about that. We have the models give us some ballpark figures, but it of course depends on what we do. how much fossil fuel heat-trapping greenhouse gases we release. So the basic thing you can be sure of is it's going to get warmer, and the more fossil fuel emissions we emit, the warmer it's going to get. And it will also change precipitation patterns dramatically around the world, even if you can't necessarily tell exactly what to the inch in what location. You can anticipate that when you mess with the climate system and putting that much heat energy in it, you're also going to change the other aspects like the precipitation.
Despite the uncertainty, you know, Kurt's talking here about the things that we do know and the models and what they predict and what we can learn through the technology that's been developed. Jillian, can you talk a little bit about how these models work, how we know what we know, how we're benefiting from new technology and new understanding?
Sure. And there's some uncertainty in terms of exactly where and when these impacts will happen, but this report does a really excellent job of giving confidence levels to every take-home message that they're reporting. So something with high confidence is using a really sound theory, multiple sources of evidence, so that's peer-reviewed science information, with really consistent results, well-documented, accepted methods, and a very high level of consensus. And then it goes down kind of from there to high, medium, and low. They also are able to assign likelihood, so kind of what's the probability that this will or will not happen? When we look globally, there's very high confidence, they rated high confidence of extreme temperatures, and they give it a likelihood of 99% to 100%. So we know that's going to happen. Can we predict exactly which summer it'll happen in Vermont? Probably not. And precipitation is likewise. So about 90% to 100% likelihood of much increased extreme precipitation. So what this report builds on is it's using more observational data, a longer history of observed climate change in the post-industrial era. And also using the latest advances in modeling, a lot of which is based off of that evidence. So really trying to pull in the latest and greatest science.
Today we're looking at how climate change is affecting and will affect our region. We're talking about a federal report that was leaked before it was officially released and now is still awaiting White House approval. We're discussing the findings with Jillian Galford, assistant professor at UVM's Gund Institute for Environment, and Kurt Steger, a professor of natural sciences at Paul Smith's College. Ryan is calling in from Montreal. Hi, Ryan. Go right ahead.
Hi. How are you guys?
Great.
So I just had a question about the runaway greenhouse effect, and if the report really goes into much detail on what that could mean for the predicted models and how, say, if the methane or the ice melts and massive pockets of methane underneath the earth are released in the air, could that that would severely accelerate the increase of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere in such a small period of time. Does the report go much into that, or I'm curious?
I can take that if you want.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead. Kurt Steger.
Yeah, sure. So this assessment mainly focuses on the United States. So what you're talking is a global picture. The idea of a runaway greenhouse is sort of fine in theory, because as you heat the earth, kind of like what Jillian was saying, there are tipping points where you start to thaw out the methane ices and the permafrost and things like that, and it sort of starts to get away from you. But to call it a runaway greenhouse also sounds like an idea that's been pretty much discredited, that the Earth would heat up to the level of Venus. Jim Hansen used to say that, and he's pulled back from it now. And so we're not going to boil the oceans off or anything like that. It's just that we do not want to cross one of these tipping points where what you're talking about does start to kick in and accelerate what we're already doing.
And let's go to Chad, who's calling in from Fairfield. Hi, Chad. Welcome to the show. You're on.
How you doing?
Hi.
Yeah, my question is, I went to a Girl Scouts with my daughter many years ago, and they were saying how, you know, the sun's always expanding and growing bigger. So, in effect, if that's happening, of course our Earth is going to warm because the sun is always getting closer to us. So that was my question.
So the question from Chad is, it sounds like, Chad, you're asking, you know, could the Earth be getting warmer because the sun is expanding and getting closer, not because of human-caused events and an increase in CO2? What do you think, Jillian?
So What this report states is that there's a very minor contribution to climate change from solar activity, volcanic activities, or any natural variabilities.
But not no increase, but a very small significance.
Very, very minor, such that they attribute human causes to a range somewhere between 92 to 123% of the changes we're seeing. So we're talking about the solar variation being less than 10%.
We also have a Canadian listener named Douglas who wrote us a lengthy email, which in part says that the increase in the Earth's temperature has paused since about 1998 in spite of increased CO2 concentration, and that there are numerous published papers to support this. He also states that the warming effect of water vapor is up to 200 times larger than that of carbon dioxide. Kurt Steger, is there a scientific basis to support those statements from Douglas?
The last one, the water vapor thing, yes, water vapor is a greenhouse gas, but I encourage Doug to dig deeper into the real physics literature, and it's clear that the main thing that's happening here is the buildup of our fossil CO2 and methane, carbon gases, so I encourage you to look more carefully into the original literature on that. As far as the pause goes in the temperature, that's an illusion of time scales. If you look at the past century, there's a clear overall trend. But as I said before, and as any good climate scientist will tell you, there's also natural variability happening. So you have these ups and downs and bounces in that curve. And if you prefer to think short term, which is not a good idea when you're looking at the big picture of climate change, but if you want to, you can find pauses all through the last century, even little slight coolings like we had around the 1960s. So clear cut, if you look carefully at the graphs, the latest data from the Northeast and from the planet as a whole, there's a clear ramping up starting around 1970, which the report mentions kind of as a turning point in the global climate system, where the temperature's been going up clearly on average. There's been changes in precipitation starting then. And it's also when the human influence really lifted off from the natural variability caused by the sun, the volcanoes, and these other things. So the thing about the pause on the temperature became a political football, but in the science community, it's just like, you know, well, big deal. It's going up again, and check out the numbers. We've had 15 of the hottest years in 136 years, all since 2001.
This report, the National Climate Report that we're talking about, says that the average annual temperatures in the Northeast could rise, as you've been saying, but could rise between 5.3 degrees and 9.1 degrees by 2071. Jillian Galford, what does that mean in practical terms for our region?
Well, there's a lot of things that are affected by temperature. If you are a dairy farmer or even a vegetable grower that you enjoy in your own home or backyard, you might see changes in productivity. There's new opportunities, too. We could see a longer growing season, which we already see Vermont farmers taking advantage of. Wine is coming into our region. But at the same time, it also brings increased risk for things like diseases and pests, or perhaps an early planting and then an unexpected freeze. Health-wise, we see more emergency department visits when we have a few days of warm overnight temperatures, and Vermonters are particularly vulnerable to that. So it doesn't take as much heat for us to end up in the emergency department as someone who lives in Florida.
Why? Because we don't have air conditioning, or because our bodies are not accustomed to it? What's the reason?
That's a great question. You know, our building infrastructure maybe isn't as good as cooling down or staying cool during these hot periods. Many of us don't have air conditioning, and yeah, so we don't cope well with the heat. It's not a Vermonter thing.
What about maple?
Maple's a great question. So some of the models of forests and how forests might change in response to temperature show that this area may not be suitable for sugar maples by the end of the century. So there's some big questions there. Now, we also see innovations coming out of Quebec in terms of how people are harvesting sap and things like that. So there's always room for us to adapt and change. But, you know, Kurt brought up resilience. So the question is, how can we build resilience now in anticipation of these future changes coming down the pipeline?
Kurt, you know, when we think about where we are in particular, though, you know, in the Adirondacks and in Vermont, Are we in some ways a little bit buffeted or buffered from some of the worst effects or worst potential effects of climate change? I mean, we're a fairly temperate climate. We generally have a pretty decent water supply with our underground water. We don't have to worry, at least in upstate New York and in Vermont, about a coastline and sea level rises. So should we feel like, hey, we picked the right place to live?
Well, I always think that, but... We don't have to worry about losing an entire lifestyle because we depend on sea ice. We don't have to worry about being flooded by sea level rise, and we don't have to worry about massive droughts like are going to be hitting the Southwest. But we do have our own issues, too, and I think a big wake-up call for me was when Irene showed up here. It was just devastating damage here in the Adirondacks, and I know in parts of Vermont too. Some of my students actually came to college late because their homes were destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
So with these extreme events, especially in uneven terrain like here in the mountains are like rain funnels, and a lot of our roads and a lot of our towns and homes are down in those valleys, which I guess we always knew they were called floodplains, but maybe forgot why they were called that. So that is something we need to worry about. It's no reason to go and get into the doom and gloom thing too much. There will certainly be some positives too, but why would we choose this mix if we didn't have to?
Do we have to? Is there a way to bend the curve?
Well, to me, I mean, I'm no policy expert, but it sure seems like, well, if we're causing it mostly by releasing these fossil fuels, the most obvious thing is to stop doing that. And it just makes sense, even if we weren't changing the climate, because it's a finite resource. It's basically a dead-end industry, just like whale oil and horse carts were 100 years ago. And it just makes economic sense to switch to these renewable industries where people could be employed and go long-term and maintain a civilization. So I think underneath it all, I sort of have hope amid the darkness that it's so sensible that even despite the politics and the culture wars, I think there's mutual benefit on all sides there.
But Jillian, we know just from human psychology that we as a species are very, very bad at thinking in the long term or thinking beyond short-term gain and short-term desires. Do you share Kurt's optimism?
I do share his optimism, and maybe it's foolish. But there's some early indicators that we could meet these targets. So the internationally agreed upon target is to allow only a 3.6 degrees, that's Fahrenheit, warming above pre-industrial levels. So in 2014 and 2015, for the first time, we saw a real slowing in emissions of greenhouse gases, not enough to yet meet the targets to hold us at that 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit warming, but it gives an indication that we could get closer. And this report really attributes that to the surge in cleaner technologies, so reduce fossil fuel burning. We see places like China really return looking to more renewable energies and investing there. There is this international accord, the Paris Agreement.
Oh, you mean the one that the U.S. is pulling out of?
So the U.S. is pulled out, but other countries have these nationally determined contributions. And the science behind that really says that there's very high confidence or high confidence that we could meet the goal to stabilize climate if these nationally determined contributions could be met. So remember, too, that sometimes these policies come from the top down. Is our nation going to mandate from the top down that we meet these requirements? Well, that's one way to get us to that goal. Another way to do it is things like solar farms that sprout up all over the place. Here in Vermont, we're seeing more renewable energy. I think there was a new wind farm going in just last week in the islands, as well as other parts of the United States. And it's great to see countries like China taking a lead on some of this.
We got a note from Mark who says, how do your guests rationally combat ignorant perceptions of climate change as being a hoax, citing anecdotal evidence like the fact that this summer in Burlington seems cooler on average than it has been in previous years? Kurt, how do you combat people, for example, like President Trump or Scott Pruitt, who have said they're not convinced that there are man-made causes for climate change? What do you say to people who still believe this?
Well, you're talking to somebody who's been dealing with this for some long time now. So, I'm getting a little tired of it. You know, I feel like we were feeling like we were moving forward, and now it looks like we're taking some steps backwards. So, I'm sort of conserving my energy now. The more I learn about people, I'm learning that some people really don't want to have their minds changed by new information. And so, you know, if you enjoy the sport of argument, go ahead. But I try to find people who are sincerely asking questions, which I think our callers who called in, Ryan and Chad and Douglas, they sounded like sincere questions. And as a science educator, I'm always happy to do that. So when we get in mixed in the culture wars and the politics, I think it can be like hitting your head against the wall.
Jillian?
Yeah, I find it frustrating when people pick and choose which parts of science they believe or don't believe. And there was a tweet this week by Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's this famous physicist, and he said, "Odd, no one is in denial of America's August 21st total solar eclipse. Like climate change, methods and tools of science predicted." So, you know, he's kind of making light of the fact that there are these issues that are really rooted in science but are contested as though, you know, we could argue our way out of it instead of actually acting on climate change.
Yeah, but I mean, it's and we don't have to debate the tweet, but I think part of it for people is what's visible? What can they see and feel and understand? How do they know who to trust when you're hearing conflicting things from federally elected officials or appointed officials and scientists? And how do you change something that may not feel like it works in your immediate favor? You know, so how do you curb activities that you really enjoy or that you feel like are helpful to you or financially helpful to you? And it's different with climate change, I think. You know, I think still for people, they have maybe a struggle in seeing, I don't understand exactly what's happening when you talk about a 2-degree temperature rise, because that doesn't seem like much to me. And it feels so far in the future that maybe I just don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, I think really what it comes down to is, can we as scientists build credibility? So a lot of times that's using information sources that people trust, like the National Weather Service, to say, hey, climate is changing in Vermont, and to address issues that people are concerned about. You know, are you going to be able to play pond hockey in 20 years in Vermont or upstate New York? And is this information that's really done in a correct process?
Kurt, do you agree?
I don't talk to you. I'm sorry, I've just had a distraction here. can you repeat it?
Let me change tack then. So, do you think that this is going to be released, this report? We're talking about this report today. I think by August 18th is supposed to be the deadline for having it released by the White House and approved. Do you think it will be?
Oh, gosh. In this political climate, I really don't know what to expect. I'm glad it was released. Even if there were some changes in it added later, I mean, the information is real. The facts are there. Multiple studies corroborated. I mean, Jillian's been involved in what, Vermont Climate Assessment, right? I see it in here and other folks too. So the data, I think, are probably not going to go away, and we really know what's up, whether or not this gets released or not officially.
That's Kurt Steger, a professor of natural sciences at Paul Smith's College in New York. Kurt, thanks very much for joining us again.
Thank you very much.
Jillian Galford is assistant professor at UVM's Gund Institute for Environment. Jillian, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks, Jane.